Thank you, Ray, for that lovely introduction. And can I just say how privileged I feel to be standing here. So many familiar faces around the table. I've got school friends, university friends. I've got parents of friends. I've got my school maths teacher. And last but not least, I've got my mum and dad. And I don't think they've ever heard me speak publicly before, so I'll be waiting for my report card when I'm finished. But thank you, Rotary, for hosting me today. It's an absolute privilege and a really worthy cause, hearing about the incubator. And after lunch, I'm going to go and visit the incubator, so I'm really excited to see that. And I'm just really thrilled for the turnout and the fundraising that's going towards this. So there's a couple of things I want to do in my speech today. The first is I'm going to briefly set out for you the Reserve Bank Board's framework for monetary policy. Some of you will be familiar with it, some of you may not. And then I'm going to give some context for the Board's decision on Tuesday, which was to hold the cash rate steady. And then I'm going to go on to the substance of the talk, which is about economic conditions in regional Australia, and talk a little bit about coming out of the pandemic and offer some reflections on challenges and opportunities which are facing regional Australia. So firstly, the Reserve Bank. So the mandate of the Reserve Bank is to promote, contribute to the economic prosperity and welfare of the Australian people. And the way we do that is by trying to deliver price stability and full employment. Now, what does this mean in practice? Well, in practice, it means setting monetary policy to keep inflation between 2 and 3% and employment at the maximum level that's consistent with maintaining low and stable inflation. And the way we achieve this is by setting the interest rate on overnight loans between banks, and we call that the cash rate. And that cash rate influences interest rates in the economy. So it affects borrowers, it affects lenders, and through that, economic activity and ultimately the rate of inflation. Now, that all sounds quite straightforward, I'm sure, but it's actually very complex. It involves the board assessing current economic conditions, and then they have to forecast how they think the economy is going to go over the next year or so. And then they need to consider the risks and trade-offs associated with that, because nothing's certain, forecasts aren't certain. And then they have to decide, well, given all that, where will we set the level of interest rates? What level of interest rates do we think is required to deliver an inflation rate of between 2 and 3% while at the same time keeping the unemployment rate as low as possible? And I think the experience since the pandemic has demonstrated just how complex this can be. Is that working? No? Yeah, there we go. It's not there. So since the pandemic, there's actually been a worldwide surge in inflation, and I think everyone here would understand cost of living is the word on everyone's lips. Initially what happened was it was driven by disruptions to supply chains. So this is an inflation rate for Australia, but it was very similar overseas. We had resurgent demand coming out of the pandemic, and at the same time, there were difficulties getting goods produced and distributed around the world, and that led to large price rises. And then, when Russia invaded Ukraine, there was a second shock, and energy prices went up dramatically. And so, as with other countries, Australia felt the impacts of these shocks. We saw inflation rise sharply, as you can see here, peaking at 7.8% at the end of 2022. We hadn't seen inflation like this in 30 years. It was dramatic. But the higher inflation wasn't all due to supply shocks. There was also a surge in demand as economies came out of the pandemic, and people were keen to spend on goods and services that were restricted during the lockdown. So what happened in response to this inflation was that central banks around the world, including us, increased interest rates very sharply. Firstly, to remove the stimulus that had been from very low interest rates, and then to move interest rates into restrictive territory where they would start to restrain demand. So Australia, as you would know, has also seen a sharp rise in interest rates. So our cash rate, our policy rate, That's risen from 0.1%, so practically zero, to 4.35% today. And the most obvious area where this has had an impact is on the interest rates paid by households with mortgages. It's increased their payments, and that in turn has reduced the amount of spare cash that they have to spend on other goods and services, and in this way it's helped to lower demand. But it's also led to an increase on interest rates on deposits, which has been beneficial for those who have savings. But these cash flow effects are just one way in which monetary policy works through the economy. Higher interest rates also reduce incentives to borrow, they lower the demand by firms to invest, and they support the exchange rate as well. And by themselves, higher interest rates weigh on asset prices and hence wealth. And all these effects lead to a lower growth in demand in the economy, and therefore helping to bring the economy back into better demand-supply balance. So this brings me to Tuesday's decision. The most recent inflation reading shows that while inflation is lower than it was a year ago, it's still too high. And inflation in many goods prices has declined, but inflation in services prices is high and it's proving very sticky. And the reason for that is that demand for goods and services in the economy is still higher than the ability of the economy to supply those goods and services. A key point here to make is that demand recovered very strongly after the pandemic to quite a high level. So even though demand growth has been fairly weak recently, this slowing hasn't been enough to restore balance to the economy. Now, the board has been trying to bring down inflation by slowing the growth of demand to bring it back into line with supply. And it's been trying to do this while preserving as many of the gains in the labour market as possible. We've described this as the narrow path. Now, at its meeting on Tuesday, the board noted two things. First of all, that although the growth in the economy has been weak, estimates suggest that the gap between aggregate demand, what people want to buy, and aggregate supply in the economy is a bit larger than we previously thought, and this is resulting in persistent inflation. It also noted that the growth of demand looks like it'll pick up over the rest of the year, although I have to say here, there's considerable uncertainty about the outlook. It's very uncertain. The effect of this is that the board's expectations for when inflation will come back to the 2-3% target range has been pushed out. And we don't expect we'll get there now until the end of 2025. So that's over a year away. And this is why the board explicitly considered whether another interest rate rise was required to ensure that inflation continues to decline in a reasonable timeframe. On balance, though, the board decided to keep interest rates on hold, judging that such an outcome would still meet the board's mandate to balance its inflation and employment objectives. But the board doesn't remain vigilant to upside risks on inflation, and it won't hesitate to raise rates if it needs to. Now, I know this is not what people want to hear, but the alternative of high inflation is worse. It hurts everyone, and I think everyone sees that now when everyone is concerned about the cost of living. So with that, I'd like to move on now to the second part of my remarks on the regional lens. So the Reserve Bank sets monetary policy for the Australian economy as a whole. Now, through the pandemic, economic conditions were relatively similar around Australia. However, the rate of growth in domestic activity often varies noticeably from one state or territory to another, and you can see that on this graph. So the black line is the national, but you can see the range around that for different states and territories. It can be quite different. So while we need to set monetary policy based on aggregate conditions, we're aware that the aggregate is just the sum of its parts. So to fully understand the overall picture, we need to understand what is going on across the country. And we're also conscious that monetary policy decisions, the effects are felt unevenly. They're not the same across all groups, all regions, all types of people. Now, the RBA has long had a dedicated team of people to gather and analyse information on economic conditions in different regions and industries. The team has staff permanently located in five Australian states, and they meet regularly with businesses, industry organisations, government agencies and community groups. The past year, in fact, they've hosted around 950 meetings with these sorts of groups. And we systematically factor this information into our forecasts, and it feeds also into the board's decisions on monetary policy. The team speaks regularly with contacts in regional areas, and it travels to different parts of the country to do this in person. And in fact, some of my colleagues have been visiting Armidale and Tamworth this week and speaking to businesses. We do this because we understand the important role of regional areas in the Australian economy. Regional Australia is estimated to account for one third of the population and one third of all economic output in Australia. And the contribution of regional areas to certain types of economic activity is substantial. For example, regional areas play a crucial role in Australia's mining and agricultural production and exports. About 50% of mining workers and 80% of agricultural workers live in the regions. So it's really important, and it's important we understand what's going on. So given the importance of regional Australia, I want to touch on how economic conditions in the regions have evolved since the pandemic compared with the capital cities. And also want to cover some medium-term challenges and opportunities for the regions. I want to make a couple of disclaimers first, though. So in this speech, I'm going to draw a distinction between regional areas that are located relatively close to capital cities and those that are further out. And that's because the ones that are close to capital cities, what we might call commutable regions, are often quite different to the more remote ones. And I also wanted to acknowledge up front that although I'm going to group regions into broad categories, we know that there's significant variations within these groups. Not everyone is the same. So, but having said that, I'm going to now present a bit on regionals as they not the commutable regions, but regional as I discussed earlier. So a standout difference in the regions since the pandemic has been population growth. No? There we go. Overseas migration all but stopped for a time in the pandemic, which led to a really sharp decline in population growth in capital cities, and you can see it from this graph. And that was followed by an even sharper pickup as restrictions eased coming out of the pandemic. If you look at regional, though, contrasting that, the regional population continued to grow at roughly the same rate as it had before the pandemic. And that's with consistently stronger growth in commutable regions, ones that are closer to the cities, than those located further from the capital cities. And as many of you know, net migration to regional areas has been high since the pandemic, as remote and hybrid working has become more common, and many workers have opted for a lifestyle change. I haven't, but some have. Changes in population dynamics can have important impact on housing markets, and we can see this, and it's a lot written in the papers about it. Population growth is clearly a key determinant of housing demand. But the other thing is it can also affect housing supply over the medium term. So, for example, if immigration helps to increase the size of the construction workforce, that can help the supply of housing. Increases in housing prices and rents were much larger in regional areas than in the cities during the pandemic, although this has slowed somewhat over the past couple of years. Overall, the cumulative increase in housing prices since the beginning of the pandemic has been higher on average in our regions than in our cities, while the cumulative rise in advertised rents have on average been pretty similar. So prices have gone up a bit more, rents pretty much the same story. In Armidale, average housing prices have risen by almost 40% since the beginning of the pandemic, while average advertised rents, they're up by almost 25%. Now, in a recent speech, one of my colleagues, Sarah Hunter, discussed how housing supply hasn't yet responded materially to the strong housing prices and rents growth. Approvals for new housing are below their average levels from 5 years ago. Yes, 5 years ago, prior to the pandemic. This is actually quite a common story. Although there's some areas where approvals are close to or above pandemic levels, including here in Armidale. More generally, though, we know that the strain on household finances from high housing costs is being felt acutely in our regional areas, as well as our cities, and this could continue for some time if construction activity remains low. Now, looking at labour markets, unemployment rates didn't rise as much in the regional areas as in the capital cities during the pandemic, consistent with shorter lockdowns and lower shares of workers employed in the services sector. After the pandemic, unemployment rates dropped significantly to very low levels across the country. This was particularly true in the commutable regional areas, the ones close to the city, possibly due to an increase in remote and hybrid workers around that time. Since then, regional labour markets have been tighter than those in capital cities, and the New England Northwest region is no exception, with an unemployment rate in that area of just 2.5% since the beginning of 2023. And that compares with an average of around 6% over the past 20 years. So the labour market is tight. While it's still at low levels, there has been a more noticeable increase in average capital city unemployment rate compared with the average regional unemployment rates to date. And you can see those moves in this graph, capital cities rising more sharply. So in addition to the short-term forces that have been at play as the effects of the pandemic have worn off, there's also some important longer-term structural factors that affect industries in different ways, and in turn the regions in which they operate. And the energy transition is one of these factors that presents both challenges and opportunities for our regions, and I'll come back to that a little bit later. First, though, I wanted to briefly discuss the changes taking place in the agricultural sector, given its importance to regional areas and the well-being of all Australians. Now, as I'm sure you're aware, this sector has been undergoing structural change in recent decades. Innovation in agriculture has boosted productivity significantly, but it's also led to a decline of jobs in the sector. The people and businesses in regional areas have had to adapt to this change, and that's always challenging, adapting to those sorts of structural changes. Investment in agricultural innovation is continuing, and the Smart Incubator is evidence of that, including in digital technologies. And technology also has its challenges in regional areas due to difficulties with access sometimes to technology, but hopefully that's something that we can overcome. So on top of this structural change, conditions in the agricultural sector also tend to be more volatile than other industries, largely due to dependence on weather. The past few years have been relatively favourable for agriculture in many regions, particularly in crop-producing areas, with high global prices and record high production volumes due to above-average rainfall. And again, you can see it in this graph, and it's forecast to remain quite high for the next few years as well. Over the past year, prices have come down a little and production is forecast to decline somewhat, but both prices and production are expected to remain at high levels in coming years. And this would certainly be a good news story if it eventuates. But of course, the future is uncertain, and increasing volatility in our weather patterns and rising temperatures over time pose challenges for farmers, and they'll be disruptive for all communities. Looking ahead, the changes that are made to mitigate the risks posed by climate change will lead to even more structural changes in our economy, including in our regions. The shift towards renewable energy sources and commitments to reduce carbon emissions mean the share of coal-driven electricity could halve over the next 10 years or so. At the same time, demand for electricity is expected to grow significantly over the coming decades as we see continued economic growth, and we also see the electrification of transport and industrial activities. And taken together, this suggests the need for greater investment in new energy generation capacity, storage and transmission. Now, Region Australia is going to play a critical role in this transition, with the majority of utility-scale solar and wind capacity for electricity generation over coming years expected to be installed in renewable energy zones. These zones may be responsible for around half of the national energy market generation over coming decades. It's likely that renewable energy zones will be primarily located in regional areas, and this is going to present many challenges, but installing this capacity and infrastructure to support it will ultimately increase investment in regional communities. This investment should bring with it significant economic benefits, including jobs and new income streams for landholders that host the infrastructure. But of course, these changes affect communities in a range of ways, and different communities are going to follow different paths in this. And I think there's going to be a process of consultation as we're on this journey. There's certainly many opportunities here, and there's some good reasons, I think, for optimism for the future of our regions. So let me conclude by just saying the RBA sets monetary policy for the Australian economy as a whole, and we only have one tool, the interest rate, to achieve our objectives. We're aware, however, that conditions do vary across the country. Regional Australia contributes greatly to the Australian economy, and so understanding the economic challenges and trends in regions is essential to the work we do at the RBA. And I hope today, in a very short time, I've provided some insight into how we're considering the regions in our analysis of the economy. So thank you for your attention, and I'm very happy now to take questions. Thank you. Now, I'm actually not sure how this is going to work. I'm happy to take questions. So if there's a hand or, and I'll try to, and there's microphones, I believe.
Just get the microphones.
Okay. Yep, okay, all right. So there's a hand right over here, first hand up.
Thank you very much, Governor, for coming out. My name is Martin. I'm at the Armidale School. My question to you is, over the past week, there's been a fair bit of volatility in global stock markets, but it's not always apparent that such volatility has anything to do with what's happening in the real economy. Does stock market volatility reflect what is happening in the real economy? And does the RBA take into account stock market volatility settling the cash rate? And if so, why is that? Thank you very much again. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for the question, and a very topical one at that. So volatility in markets doesn't necessarily relate to the real economy. So I'll just explain a little bit what happened. So what happened was in the United States on Friday night, they got an employment number which was much less than people were expecting, and they thought, oh, no, the US economy is going to go into recession. Everyone had been thinking, oh, the economy's going along really nicely. And so all of a sudden everyone thought, oh, no, it's going into recession. And stock market valuations at least partly reflect what people think is going to happen in the future with the economy. So to the extent that people thought this doesn't bode well for the economy, they started selling stocks. But it wasn't quite that simple, though. At the same time, the Bank of Japan raised interest rates in Japan, and there's this thing called, it's technically called a carry trade, but what it means is that investors borrow really cheap money in Japan, where interest rates are practically zero, and then they invest it in things that yield high yields. So they invest it in the United States in the stock market, which is growing up really sharply. So when this happened, a lot of people who had borrowed lots of money cheap in Japan and spent it in the stock market thought, oh, I better get out. US is turning down, Japan's raising interest rates, I've got to unwind all my trades. So this is sometimes what happens. Markets can feed on themselves, and they react more sharply than you would expect given something as simple as one employment number in the United States. Things have settled down since then, but I think it's worth keeping an eye on, and the reason it's worth keeping an eye on is because if there's a lot of volatility in financial markets, it does affect sentiment, it does affect people's incentives to invest and businesses and households. So we can't ignore it completely, but it isn't the economy. So that's sort of a longish answer. I hope that was okay.
Question here.
Yes, thank you. My name's Andrew, and thank you very much for making the time to come here, Governor. I have two questions, maybe, if I can approach. One is, there's been some discussion in Canberra around the government exercising its power to overturn a potential interest rate increase. My question is, what do you think that might do to our reputation in global markets? And the second one is, whether you think currently our fiscal policy statement is aligned with the objectives of the RBA?
Sure. So on the discussion about overruling interest rates, there's a section called Section 11 in the Reserve Bank Act, which does allow the government to, it's a process they've got to go through. The bank and the government can't agree, and the government can technically overrule the bank. It's never happened. It's never been used. It's very much a nuclear option. My feeling is it's if it did happen, I think it would have an impact on what people see as an independent central bank. But I don't actually think we're in any danger of that happening. And some other central banks have similar sorts of... I know the Bank of England, for example, has a similar sort of clause in its act as well. So, but as I say, it's never been used, and I can't foresee it being used. On fiscal policy, governments have a job to do and I have a job to do. My job and the Reserve Bank's job is to get inflation down. The governments have a different job. Their job is also to get inflation down, and they acknowledge that, but it's also to provide services and infrastructure for the Australian people. And so they need to do that at the same time as they need to focus on keeping inflation down. So my personal view is that they're doing what they can do in that area, and I'm doing what I can do in that area.
Governor, Ross is my name. I was lucky enough to go to the University of New England as well. And one of the things I learnt was something about monetary policy, but recently, or historically, the American interest rates are always sort of a couple of percentage points below ours. Is that right?
Well, it depends which rate you're talking about. Their short-term rate, their policy rate, is above ours, actually.
At the moment?
Yes,
in the past, it's always been below by a couple of percent,
well,
I thought.
Yeah, it depends on what averages you take over time. Sometimes it's above, sometimes it's below.
Okay, well, that's probably ruined the question.
Tell me the question anyway.
Well, I thought that was the position, and I thought at the moment, American interest rates are actually, you know, 1% above ours.
Yeah.
So I was wondering if that comes into your thought process when you're doing your monetary policy settings,
yeah.
And what does it mean for the Australian dollar, which is very important to rural Australia, and what is it do, and our interest rates? Is that?
Yeah, no, that's a good question, and let me give you what I think is a hopefully a good answer. So the thing about so interest rates overseas in Australia can vary, and they do vary, as you say. At the moment, interest rates in the United States are higher than us. That's been we've been criticised for that, in fact. We've been criticised by some people saying our interest rates should be more up near where the United States ones are. But we've chosen, as I said earlier, very deliberately to try and bring inflation down while not turning the economy into a recession and spiking unemployment. That's been our strategy. But because we have a floating exchange rate, as you rightly say, it does mean that we have the ability to set interest rates as we think they are appropriate for our economy. And that does give us room to set interest rates different from overseas, but as you rightly point out, it has implications for the exchange rate. So at the moment, with US interest rates higher than ours, that's probably keeping our dollar a little bit lower. But if the interest rates in the US start to decline, which people are expecting, that will probably give a bit more support to our exchange rate, so our interest rates won't be so far apart. The exchange rate, it does impact particularly exporters, so as the exchange rate declines, it's good for exporters that are selling in US dollars because they get more income. And when the exchange rate appreciates, as you note, that's more difficult for exporters. But the exchange rate does play a role in helping to keep keep inflation in the band as well. So when we put up interest rates, normally, if no one else was moving interest rates, that would put a bit of upward pressure on our exchange rate. That would mean that imports would be a bit cheaper, exports would be a bit more expensive, and that would help to lower inflation. At the moment, everyone had increased their interest rates coming out of the pandemic, so we didn't really get much action from the exchange rate. But over the next while, as different countries go different ways, it is going to come back into play. So we can set interest rates for the conditions that we want to in Australia, but we do have to be conscious that it's going to impact the exchange rate, and that's something that we obviously don't ignore in our monetary policy decisions.
Governor, I'm David Hadley. I'm current head of Harry Business and Economics at UNE. This isn't really a question, it's more an observation which I'd be interested in your commentary on. We're having trouble getting students to do economics.
Yeah.
Postgrad, undergraduate level, to the point where our degree may not survive for much longer, which has happened at a number of regional universities.
Yeah.
This really worries me, because it seems to me that the problems that society faces nationally or globally are ultimately economic problems. Cost of living is an obvious case in point, but climate change is an economic problem.
Yeah.
It has economic causes. We need economic solutions to it. So if economic thinking is only in the hands of a small elite at the G8 universities, and the vast majority of people don't understand economics, how can we solve those problems?
Yeah. Yeah, it's you've highlighted an issue that is close to our heart at the Reserve Bank. So we have a, and I don't have the solutions, and there's certainly no short-term solutions. We have a team at the Reserve Bank, one of my colleagues from that area is here today, who focus on public education. That is their focus. And they spend a lot of time focusing on school students to try and get the pipeline into economics. At university at least, set up. Two problems with the pipeline for economics that you've highlighted, but I'd be even more stark. It's typically city universities. Economics at school is typically studied by boys in private schools. Public schools increasing. Now, I went to Armidale High this morning, Armidale Secondary College this morning, and they had a year 11 and a year 12 class in economics. 20 students, all up two were women, which highlights the other problem. There's not many women. So it is an issue, because diversity is absolutely key to having a good economic debate. Economics isn't black and white. It needs differences of opinion. It needs people to be debating issues. And you highlighted the environment as being one, but there's all sorts of applications of economics and all sorts of things. It's not all about the financial markets. So I don't have a solution, but we are doing our bit by trying to get around to schools, to support teachers in teaching economics in schools, which hopefully will have a flow-on impact for universities. And we really need to address the diversity question that you're talking about. So we do research in it, and we're trying to do our little bit. But I don't have a silver bullet for you, but I absolutely get where you're coming from.
Hello, Michelle, my name's Claire. I just had a question on interest rate, cash rate. I think historically the average over 30 years is around 6%, obviously 4.25 now, and possibly going down or maybe going up. To know productivity and the technological impact, where do you see long-term interest cash rate ending up?
Yeah, so so I'll give a technical answer, or I'll try and give a non-technical answer. So the way we think about interest rates is in the context of what we might call a long-run neutral interest rate. And that in theory at least, is the interest rate at which it's neither expansionary for the economy nor contractionary for the economy. And the neutral interest rate is typically thought of as a real interest rate, so it's interest rate after inflation. Now, estimates of that interest rate vary over time, and it depends. It's often a global concept, because it depends, interest rates depend on effectively savings and investment. So if you get lots and lots of savings and not much investment, the interest rate tends to go down. Natural interest rates tend to go down, and you get the reverse if investment is high and savings is low. So, having said that, where the interest rate, neutral interest rate is, and where it might be going into the future, is going to depend, therefore, on what we think the neutral interest rate is. It might be around about 1%, but who knows, real. And then if you add inflation on top of that, so say 2.5%, because that's our target, that might give you a neutral interest rate nominally of, say, 3.5%-ish, say. Neither expansionary nor contractionary. So if you think going forward where interest rates are going to head in terms of their long run level, I think that is one place to start. But then you think, well, what's going to happen to investment and savings as we go forward? In the past, interest rates were very low because there was big savings going on in Asia and big glut of savings and not much investment, so interest rates went down. If you go out into the future, you might think that the energy transition, there's going to be a lot of need for investment, so that might put upward pressure on the interest rate. So I couldn't forecast what it's going to be in the future. At the moment, at 4.35%, we think we are restrictive. We think we are above the interest rate that would be neutral. But what it is going out into the future is going to depend on what happens to savings and investment, and it's also going to depend on inflation. So that's why it's critical we keep inflation down to around about 2.5%.
Sure.
A quick one from me. You're the first governor to have to deal with unwinding quantitative easing. When your predecessor was in this room a few years ago, I asked him how he was going to do it and had he tried, and he said yes, he had tried and he knew how it was going to work. When the cash rate got to 0.1, you were out of bullets, you had to use quantitative easing. How's the unwinding of that happening? I noticed recently you took some on your balance sheet, some of the loss. Are you prepared to take more of it on your sheet, or are you going to hand it back to the Treasurer where it belongs, the debt? I'm sure in the long run you don't want the loss on your balance sheet.
Well, there's so many questions built up in that one. So let me, for those in the room, quantitative easing, let me just describe what it is. When interest rates got down to 0.1, practically zero, we had nowhere else to go in terms of lowering interest rates. Some countries overseas tried negative interest rates, as in paying people to take debt, but we didn't go there. So instead what we did was we bought government bonds in the financial markets, and the idea of that was to try and lower the yield on longer term government bonds. But what that meant was we had a very large balance sheet. We ended up with a balance sheet of about $600 billion. Reflecting that and some other things. So that was quantitative easing. So the idea was you actually go out and buy bonds and that you try to put liquidity into the market and bring down interest rates in that way. We now have a very large government bond portfolio as a result of that. And what happens when interest rates go up is that bond prices effectively are going down. And so we've got all these bonds on our balance sheet and the price of them is going down. So we've got big unrealised losses on our balance sheet. And the other thing is that we are paying interest, the cash rate, we're paying 4.35% to banks that hold balances on our balance sheet. And the earnings of the bonds that we've got, these bonds were basically earning us, 1%, 2%. So we're paying interest at 4.35% and we're earning about 1.5% on our assets. So anyone in business knows that this is not a good look. We do have now a very large loss on our balance sheet. It's about $20 billion, I think, in negative equity that we have. Central banks, though, are not like other banks. They're not like commercial banks. We create money, so we can continue to run with that loss on our balance sheet. But what it means is that when we start to make profits again, and we will start to make profits again, we will have to use those profits to recapitalise our balance sheet. And so, in a sense, normally what happens when we make profits is we would give a dividend to the government. It means the government is not going to get dividends for some years because we are going to use the profits that we make to recapitalise our balance sheet. So I hope that sort of answers the question. Can't hear you. Another microphone.
Question over here while we're waiting. Bede Burke. Thanks, Michelle. Michelle, your predecessor had a pretty rocky ride towards the end of his tenure as governor of the Australian of the Reserve Bank. And I think a lot of it went back to a statement that he made about interest rates not rising to the particular long point of time in the future. How do you sandbag your own career and learn from mistakes that probably were quite, almost insignificant at the time it was made, but it became part of his legacy?
Yes, it did, and it was unfortunate because it was a thing called forward guidance, and what he said was, if people had listened carefully, was that we would maintain interest rates as low as possible because we were emergency settings. You know, the pandemic, it was an emergency for the economy. And what he said was, we won't raise interest rates until we're convinced we're going to be sustainably back in the band for inflation. And on current forecasts, I don't expect that to be until 2024. He had qualifications around it, but of course people focused on 2024. Now, other countries have used these sorts of forward guidance as well. I think the challenge in Australia was that we are a predominantly variable rate mortgage society. A lot of other countries aren't. In fact, the United States, they have 30-year fixed mortgages. So short-term interest rates don't impact them much, but they had a very big impact here. So people who thought he promised that interest rates wouldn't go up until 2024 were very upset. What am I doing? Well, you won't hear me say that interest rates won't go up. I think the lesson from that was we have to be very careful. It was a conscious decision to give forward guidance. We were in emergency settings. But I think the lesson is you have to be quite careful. So, thank you. How are we going with the microphone? We're good?
Hello, brilliant. My name is Tyler and I'm from the Armidale School. It has been said that we are currently experiencing a three-speed economy in inflation, where inflation in discretionary goods has already peaked and is now back to about zero. Non-discretionary goods continue to flatten out but remain just outside the RBA's target band, while essential services remain high and is trending even higher. I was hoping to find out how the RBA intends to remedy the increasing inflation in essential services without negatively impacting the other two sectors.
Well, you've just nailed the question. We have to think about inflation globally, and I know a lot of people say, well, if you can't impact inflation in particular areas, then and they're causing the problem, then don't affect the rest of the economy just because you can't affect those. It's not that easy, though. We do have to think about inflation as a total. We can't pick out particular items and say, well, we want inflation there to be lower, so we'll squeeze this little bit of demand. We've only got one tool, which is the interest rate. What you've highlighted, though, I think, is that it is having an impact because we are seeing discretionary goods inflation come down. The things that we're seeing taking longer, which you're highlighting, are the services sorts of side of the economy, and they will start to come down, but they're just naturally stickier than goods. And part of the reason is because labour is often a very important input to that. So a lot of businesses, particularly in the services sector, are seeing wage rises and other non-labour costs, things like insurance, for example, going up. So those sorts of things are impacting their costs and they're passing them on to their customers. But as demand comes down, they'll find it harder to pass it on to their customers. So it is, I believe, going to work. It is going to bring inflation down, but it's just going to be slower in those components. We don't have a luxury with one interest rate in being able to impact different sectors differently. We've got one blunt interest rate mechanism, and that's what we have to use. But it's an excellent question, and it's something that certainly occupies the minds of me, my colleagues, and the board. So, great question. Thank you.
Question here, Michelle.
Michelle, my name's Sean. Whilst you're on that, what the board's thinking, with the dual mandate you're running, and you're forecasting unemployment to peak out around 4.5% midway through next year. What happens if we sail through that level and inflation is still here? What's the thinking of the board?
So if we sail through that level and inflation is still a problem, what that's probably telling us is that there's some structural issues in the labour market, which mean that we don't have... So there's always some level of unemployment. Partly it's frictional, so people leaving one job, moving to another. Partly structural, so as skills change, as the workforce changes, and you need different skills, there might be a mismatch between the unemployed and the skills that are needed. So if it sails through that level and the unemployment rate sails through that level and inflation doesn't come down, what that's probably telling us is that there is a certain structural element of unemployment which is there and we can't do anything about that. That's sort of... So you're alluding to a concept which is called the NIRU, the non-inflation accelerating rate of unemployment. If you are above that, you would typically see inflation falling, and if you're below it, you'd typically see inflation rising. So if we sail through and inflation's still there, that's suggesting that level of unemployment that we can maintain while having stable inflation is higher than we thought. Now, coming out of the pandemic, we hope that is actually lower than it was prior to the pandemic. And we're still, that's still what our forecasts are telling us, and that's still what we're baking in. But again, forecasts are uncertain, so we have to wait and see.
Hi, Michelle. Thanks for coming out. I'm Hamish from Mohammed Al Secondary College. I have a question for most of us students here. Apart from renewables, where do you see future job opportunities and industry growth for future generations?
Very good question, too. All the students are asking the really good questions. Put me on the spot. So technology, obviously, is a very big one. So I think that there's going to be a lot of opportunities in technology, and that's technology applied to all sorts of things. It's not just renewables, it's also to agriculture, it'll be technology applied to our resources sector as well, these sorts of things. So I think they're going to be really important jobs. It's also true that as economies become wealthier, they tend to move from goods to services. So there's going to be lots more jobs in services areas. Where we're seeing a lot of growth at the moment in the employment market is, in fact, in education and health. And as is going to happen in Australia, the population ages, there's going to be many more jobs in those sorts of areas as well. So I think that as the structure of the economy changes, this is the sorts of things you're going to see. Lots of technology sort of related jobs in a variety of fields, and I also think you're going to see much more jobs growth in the services sector, and some of that is going to be government and some of it is going to be private.
Question from one of our sponsors.
Thanks, Michelle. Thanks, Governor, for coming home. I know this room is justifiably proud of you, so thank you for coming home. Yes, David Hine from Regional Australia. Good to see you again. The bank does more than just monetary policy. Payments policy. Tommy Gunnar has spoken about many times. What's the current agenda? And with the benefit of hindsight of looking at issues such as scams and fraud, do you have a new view on the advent of faster payments, real-time payments, etc.?
Okay, another double-barrel question. So the payment system is interesting. So I spent a lot of my career in the payment system, in fact, where I met David. Most of us don't think about it until it doesn't work. And particularly now with cash use going down, and a lot of people don't carry cash anymore. I do. I quite like having cash in my wallet, but I know a lot of people who don't carry it at all. And so we are very much in the hands of the digital. What we are focusing, I guess, on is resilience of payment systems at the moment, because if people are relying on digital payment systems and they fall over, then commerce stops. No one can spend any money. This is sort of periodically happened in the city, and actually, interestingly, it doesn't need to be the payment system itself. You might recall the CloudStrike. I don't know if some of you heard about the CloudStrike incident, which brought down a whole lot of Windows PCs. Some businesses just had to shut because they couldn't even operate their tills. So as technology is becoming more and more ingrained in everything we do, its resilience is posing risks to commerce. So that's one thing that's on our agenda. On the fast payments issue, yes, I think fast payments are great, but I do accept that there are circumstances where, in particularly with scams on the rise, that if you've paid away and it's gone in a minute, it's very hard to get it back. I think the banks are taking this responsibly. What the banks are doing is try to identify what might be high-risk transactions and making sure they slow them down, introducing a bit of friction into the process there. But technology is going to help here too. And the banks have lots of technology, as you know, and AI is increasingly being used here in order to identify what look like suspicious movements and transactions. So I'm by nature, I guess, a bit of an optimist, but I think it's going to be an issue, but I think the banks are doing what they can, and I still think that it's worth... We have a world-class payment system in Australia, and I think it's still worth maintaining the fast payment system and building on it myself.
Okay. Hello, Michelle. My name's Stella. In the last few months, political debate around energy alternatives, as well as the changing nature of energy prices stemming from conflict in the Middle East, has caused energy prices to fluctuate rapidly. What has been the influence on energy prices on inflation, and how do you expect alternative energy sources and a wider conflict in the Middle East to influence inflation in the future?
Mm. Excellent question. Nice to see a young woman studying economics. Yay. another really good question. So when we think about energy price shocks, that sort of the ones we've experienced and potentially experience in the future, central banks typically try to look through those things because they influence inflation sharply, but then it washes out again, often as prices come down again, or the level goes up and it stays at the same level. And inflation is a growth concept. So you might get a big step up in the energy price level and it stays there, but once it stays there, its inflation is zero in effect. So central banks try to look through those sorts of supply shocks. The challenge, I think, and you alluded to the future, the challenge is that if there are more of these shocks and they build on one another, then you've constantly got this impulse to inflation from this exogenous force that central banks can't affect. We can't do anything about it. Interest rates don't affect it. It's coming from the supply side. And what can potentially happen there is that if people expect, they look at the headline inflation rate, even though it's caused by energy, and they think, therefore, that inflation is always going to be this high. This is the challenge. I hope we don't end up in that world because it is very challenging to deal with from a central banking perspective. But it is possible, and it's particularly possible as we move into a world where we're trying to transition to more renewable energy. And as you say, obviously heightened geopolitical risks in this area as well. But in theory, at least, we should be able to try and look through those particular impulses and wait for them to roll out of the numbers. And what we try to focus on is what's happening to more underlying prices instead.
Here, Michelle.
Thanks, Michelle. Matthew Sweeney from Tamworth. You've mentioned a couple of times in previous speeches about productivity.
Mm-hmm.
So we seem to be talking today very much about the CPI side, but on GDP, we're in negative productivity territory. So if I'm a business and I can only produce one widget, I've got to charge a certain price to cover my cost. By producing five widgets, I can charge less. So it's more of a supply side issue. What can businesses do to look at that at the demand side, the supply side, I should say, not just focus on that supply side?
So, yeah, we haven't talked about productivity, but that's actually really crucial. So productivity is about how many resources you need to produce certain amount of goods and services. And in order to grow the economy and in order to increase our standard of living, we need to be able to use the same amount of resources to produce more. That's what an increase in productivity is all about. And at the moment, productivity is not looking great. Now, two cautions, I suppose. One is that coming out of the pandemic, productivity numbers have been all over the place, so it's a bit difficult to read what's happening in a trend sense. But it's true that going into the pandemic, productivity growth had slowed quite a lot. And even to get back to sort of that low level of productivity, we need that if we're going to be able to sustain reasonable wage rises. So a typical rule of thumb might be if we can get 1% productivity growth and 2.5% inflation, then we should be able to sustain wage rises of about 3.5%. But if we can't get any productivity growth, then it's very difficult to have growth in wages of around about 3.5% without adding to inflation, because of your point, it goes directly to the bottom line of the businesses. So it's really crucial. There's nothing I can do about it, but there's plenty of ideas out there. We do have a productivity commission, and things like technology and education are key to productivity. And so we've got to put more emphasis on that. We've got to, and the productivity commission's got lots of ideas, but it's not all government, businesses have got to be innovative as well and look for opportunities. And the Smart Incubator, I think, is one example of where they're looking for ways to improve productivity. But it's absolutely crucial.
Speaking of education,
question here from Simon Evans.
Thank you. Governor, in your remarks, you touched on population, in particular on migration. And the government has been proposing a host of measures to reduce that overseas migration. The headline measures this week around international students with a focus on housing prices in metropolitan areas as a key policy driver. What impact do those kinds of policy changes have on the things that interest you, like productivity in the economy more broadly? I'm not asking you to editorialise, obviously, on government policy, but how does it feed into your thinking, and what kinds of settings are most conducive to the economic outlook? Parameters that you are mandated to pursue.
Sure. So I think in the most recent rapid increase in migration, I think our view is that if you just looked at what that's done to inflation, it's probably been net a wash. The reason I say that is because, yes, migrants come in and they spend, but they also add to the supply side of the economy. And coming out of the pandemic, some of you may remember, labour shortages were rife. We just didn't have people to do the jobs. And so they've added to the supply side of the economy as well. So probably in terms of inflation, what we care about, it's probably been pretty much a wash. Where it's shown up, though, is where is in the capital stock and the housing stock. And that is very slow moving. The housing supply is a very slow moving thing. And when you get a big increase in demand, which you do with migration, you end up obviously with pressure on housing prices and rents. Interestingly, though, that's not the whole story. It's not, rents and housing prices is not just a migration story. It's also a story about a long-term decline in household size in Australia. So we've seen household sizes decline over time for a few decades. And during the pandemic, it's declined even more. People who used to perhaps have a few flatmates now think, no, I want a spare room. So people, and as the population ages, children move out. My house is one example, a big four-bedroom house and two people living in it. You know, so that adds to the demand for the stock of housing, and the supply side isn't responding quickly enough. So that does play into our inflation forecast, but it is something that will eventually work its way through, but it takes time.
Thank you, Michelle. We only have two questions left for you. You're doing brilliant. Sure.
One here and then one down the back from the press.
Hi, my name is Rosie. I'm a current student at UNE in my last year. I'm actually at one of the colleges to battle. My question is very different to questions so far. What is your advice for young students going into the industry? Although I'm not going into economics, rather accounting, what is your advice, your general advice, going into industry?
General advice. I probably need to preface it with a disclaimer of some description, don't I? My advice would be to, when you move into work, it's a team environment. So my advice to anyone coming from university to the workforce is to take advantage of the team around you. You will be working with people who are more experienced. You'll probably have some people that are like you. When I came into the workforce coming out of university, I was lucky to be surrounded by people who had a few years extra experience than me, and senior managers who actually were very happy to share their knowledge. So my advice would be just take it. Just move into the team environment, get working with the team, soak up as much knowledge as you possibly can. And people like to be asked questions. They like that people are curious. So that would be my main bit of advice, I think, to you.
Thank you, Governor. It's John Keogh from the Australian Financial Review. Good to be in Armidale, and good to see the students here showing up, some of the journalists with their questions as well. At your press conference on Tuesday, you said words to the effect that you struggled to see an interest rate cut in the next 6 months, which would take us through to at least February next year. The money markets, though, since you made those comments, are still betting on an interest rate cut by December. So my question is, how strongly do you hold that conviction? I know it's not any formal forward guidance or anything like that, but it's your best guess at the moment. And what would it take for you to maybe change that view, such as would need a material increase in unemployment or a material decrease in core inflation?
So the context of this is that inflation obviously is still very sticky and it's still too high. And I made those comments with the qualification of based on what we know now and based on what the board knows now and what the board is forecasting. We don't see interest rates coming down quickly. This was also in the context of when I was asked earlier about the volatility in financial markets. You recall that all of a sudden people are thinking, oh, emergency rate cuts from the Fed, the Reserve Bank's got to follow. I think it's really important that we just have a very consistent approach. We don't react to one number. This is reacting to the wealth of information that's coming through. Is there one thing that would change my mind? No, there's not one thing. There's a multitude of evidence that would need to. Unemployment would be one, inflation would be another, a dramatic change in circumstances overseas, which really affected our trading, for example. These are all the sorts of things that I think we'd be focusing on. So I can't give you one thing that would change my mind. But I will say that if something does happen and it looks like we are turning down much more quickly than we thought, then the board won't hesitate to take the right decision there either, and they will lower interest rates. It's just that at the moment, given where inflation is, given employment's still growing quite well, given what we're hearing from our liaison programs about still some tightness out there, we just can't see what it is at the moment that's going to allow us to lower interest rates. Remember that we didn't go up as far as everyone else. We're arguably a little bit less restrictive than everyone else. So we need to be a little bit careful. Thank you all.